This is the Self-Storage Podcast, where we share the knowledge and skills from the industry's leading investors, developers, and operators to help you launch and grow your self-storage business. I'm your host, Scott Myers, and over the past 16 years, we have acquired, developed, converted, and syndicated over 2 million square feet of self-storage nationwide with the help of my incredible team at selfstorageinvesting.com, who has helped thousands of people achieve greatness in self-storage. Ever wonder how to break into the self-storage business without actually buying a facility? Well, that's exactly what today's guest has done by creating a steady flow of opportunities that he wholesales to other self-storage investors. Fernando Angelucci is the 28-year-old senior partner of Titan Wealth Group based out of Chicago, Illinois. And like many of us, he became inspired by reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad when he was 16 years old and then started his first business at the age of 19 while attending the University of Illinois. After college, he went on to work at a Fortune 50 company and began investing in single-family homes on the side. And by the age of 23, he was able to replace his income and exited the 9-to-5 life to invest in single-family and multifamily properties full-time. A year later, he attended our self-storage academy and began investing in value-add self-storage facilities nationwide and raising funds to syndicate his deals. Fernando is also a member of our self-storage mastermind and contributes not only a great deal of in-the-trenches information, but also a steady flow of properties to our members to buy or partner on. So without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with master wholesaler Fernando Angelucci. Fernando, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time out. It's pretty busy these days for folks that are doing what you're doing in self-storage, correct?
Yeah, very busy.
Well, I wanted to touch on that. There's an awful lot at the time that this podcast is coming out right now. We're on the tail end of coming out. The economy is turning back on. Things are picking back up again. You know, we pivoted and we've adapted and working harder than ever, just going in a couple different directions. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to talk about mainly is I want to jump right in and talk about really where your focus is on the, well, you are a master at marketing and getting deals in the pipeline, but I want to talk to you about the wholesale side of your business, because there's not a whole lot of folks in self-storage that are wholesaling self-storage facilities. We see it a lot in single family homes and some of the lower priced asset classes, but not very often in self-storage. So can you tell us a little bit about how you go about doing that?
Yeah, so before I got into self-storage, I started off as a wholesaler of single family and multifamily properties. And I used that to kind of test prices and my underwriting until I was feeling comfortable to start buying my own properties. So we did the same thing with self-storage. While we were learning self-storage with you, we wanted to make sure that there were other investors out there that'd be willing to buy properties at prices above what we have negotiated. And it really helped because it was a sounding board. When we first started looking at these properties, at these self-storage facilities, we were still building, you know, what type of documents do we need? What do investors think are important? What numbers do they find important? What are the ranges that they find as far as acceptable deals, both on the value add side and for stabilized property? And after wholesaling a few of them, then we actually started buying ourselves. But one of the things that I noticed is that there's a lot of investors new to self-storage that are having trouble finding good deals. And when you only rely on brokers, it's very difficult because once a property hits the open market, then you have a ton of eyes on it. It's very difficult to negotiate a really good deal. The more eyes on the property, the higher the price is going to be. So that's how we started off in the wholesale and self-storage. Once we started buying our own properties, we kind of took a hiatus from doing that for a while. But in the mastermind, we were talking about how there should be no reason that any deals are moving to people outside the mastermind.
Absolutely.
And that means that we have to find a way to monetize all deals. Just because a deal doesn't make sense for me doesn't mean it won't make sense for somebody else. If for example, the biggest thing that's coming through our funnels now that we decide to wholesale is any property that's below 25,000 net rentable square feet. It's just too small for us now. But I remember when I was first starting out, a 16 or a 20,000 square foot property was a great starting point to get your feet wet in the storage space. You still have very high cap rates in that range. You're not competing with any REITs or any regional players. And it allows you to walk into these value adds and almost kind of dip your toe into the water with a smaller facility, turn it around so that once you move on to the 50 or the 100,000 square foot properties, you kind of already know, you've already gone through the steps.
And that's, you know, Really good point, and a couple things that I wanted to touch on there, Fernando. It's great. I think it takes the pressure off if you come into the business thinking that, you know what, this may not be a deal for me, but I'm going to look at and I'm going to underwrite everything, and I'm going to get real good at, you know, wringing every last penny out of this thing and then seeing if it's something that I'm interested in or not. And even if I'm not, say maybe it's too far away or, you know, too big or too small, as you mentioned, you know, if it still is a deal, then somebody will want it. And there's a difference, as we talked about and you touched on in the mastermind, you know, there's opportunities and then there's deals. And so you're right. I think so many people get tripped up that they can't fill their funnel and they can't find perhaps exactly what they're looking for. But I think that's a fantastic approach to take. And then you get, I mean, you're not really using other people's money. You're just underwriting deals with the hopes that either you make money on it by owning it, or you make money on it by wholesaling it off or getting a referral fee out to somebody else. So with that in mind, tell me what is your criteria in terms of what are you going to keep? What do you decide that outside of the 25,000 that you're going to market to somebody else? And then is there a formula for how many you decide to, you know, for every so many that you decide to keep, you're going to sell so many. Give us an idea what that looks like.
Yeah. So for us, we're trying to increase the average size of our facilities. As we become better operators and larger operators, these smaller properties, the amount of work that goes into them just doesn't make sense as far as the economies of scale. For example, we just created a self-storage income fund where it doesn't really make sense to be putting in $200,000 properties at a pop because it's a $12 million fund. That'd be a ton of properties, right? So we need to focus on $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million properties to fill up that fund. And then it also helps with the management side. We have centralized management. So everything is managed from our office in Des Moines, Iowa. And when we have to hire, you know, a new property manager, a new boots on the ground just to take care of a 60 unit facility, it just doesn't make sense. That salary, it's not really being paid for from the income of that property. As we've gotten larger, our team has also gotten larger, which means our overhead has gotten larger. So we really need to chase these deals that are producing just larger dollars each month to support our staff. Another thing that we look at, whether we're going to be holding the property or wholesaling it, is geography. So we're based in the Midwest. We really like the Midwest. We think there's a lot of value out here. Outside of the Midwest, I think there is a lot of value as well. And we look at some of those, but we don't want to go into a market that we're not familiar with or maybe doesn't have as preferential tax treatment. Unfortunately, I live in Illinois, so it's very difficult to invest in my own state. But, you know, in Indiana, there's really good deals. The taxes are amazing. Same thing in Iowa. So when we do go outside of the Midwest, we're looking for states that are very lenient on taxes. So for example, we don't do anything in California. We don't do anything in New York. But there are tons of investors that those are the only areas they want to invest in, either because that's the area they know or that's where they're from and they don't want to drive more than 2 or 3 hours to go manage these facilities. So that's a great opportunity of a deal that would have been lost in our funnel. We would just said, hey, you know, we're not interested. Thanks for calling. Where now we can go and move them to an investor. And because 95% of the deals that come into our funnel are off market, we're usually the only one at the table negotiating on the property. So that allows us to bring these deals to other investors that we wouldn't be interested at, but at very good cap rates. We're typically selling deals to our investors anywhere between a 10 to a 14% cap rate on the back end. And as far as that's for value add projects, for stabilized projects, we're usually seeing stuff in the 8 to 10% range. And that's another thing too, right? We only like to buy value add projects, specifically heavy value add. We don't really like anything that's stabilized or almost stabilized, but there's a lot of investors out there that do. They maybe don't want to, you know, deal with all the headaches of bringing a property up to, you know, its highest and best potential. And they just want to have something a little bit more passive where they just, you know, shell out $1 million and then it just returns 8% every year, you know?
And I would say the few deals that we have wholesaled or sold to other investors once we've underwritten, it ticks those boxes where, you know, you and I are looking for the extreme value add, you know, and the multiple X return on the back end. There are some folks that are looking for a turnkey with maybe a little bit of value add, but still humming right along. And they want to be, you know, as passive as you could be, but as an active investor owning the thing themselves. And we've had a few folks that are interested in those projects in the same fashion that you mentioned. But let's, without divulging your business model and creating competition for yourself, tell us just a little bit, Fernando, about, you know, if somebody's looking to, you know, become a wholesaler, you know, in self-storage or commercial properties, you know, how do you set your fees? I mean, obviously that's very important that there has to be enough to make it worth your while. And then also not too much that it overburdens the property for the next person coming along. So give us an idea as to what that looks like.
So I wish there was an easy formula to give you, but there's not. And really the market sets the fee. So for example, if I know in this given area, so let's say it's a tertiary market and it's a C-class property, I know that investors on my list will probably pay around 10% for that deal or a 10% cap rate, which means I have to do my darndest to get the price at a place where I can make a spread. So if I'm able to get the property under contract at say a 10.5% cap rate, then my fee is the difference between that 10.5 cap rate and that 10% cap rate when I send it out to market. So there's some deals where I make very little on. We're actually about to do a wholesale deal right now with another mastermind student. Well, we're only going to make $11,000 on it. On the other side, I've done deals where we've negotiated a steal of a deal. And I've made a $240,000 assignment fee. So it's really across the range, but it always comes back to what is the market willing to pay for this? And we then set the price based off what the market is willing to pay. And then we know what our benchmark is when we go to negotiate it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is really important for wholesalers out there is that, you know, just because you're not going to be the end buyer doesn't mean that you don't have to do all the work. You have to do all the work. You have to underwrite these things as if you're going to buy them. And that's going to be your best way to get a smooth transaction. Obviously, the workload with self-storage underwriting is much larger than, say, with a small $50,000 single family home. But the payouts are also much larger. So you need to keep that in mind. A cash buyer or an end buyer, if they're using financing, they're not going to want to pay you $100,000 if all you tell them is, hey, here's the address of the property, here's the owner's phone number, now go do it. That's not what they're looking for. Usually the people that utilize our services, the reason they're utilizing them is because, one, they don't have the time to sift through the large number of properties that we do. Number two, they kind of want something that's almost ready to go, where you just hand it off to them. They review your work, they check it against, you know, any other third party that they're using, and then they fund the transaction. If they have to go in and do all the work that they would have done if they were to buy the property themselves without the use of a wholesaler, why would they pay you a fee for that? Mm-hmm. So I think that's super important. You know, we even go as far as already lining up lenders. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we're approaching a deal, regardless if we know we're going to wholesale or not, we do the full underwriting packet, and then we give that packet to a bank, and then we tell the bank, hey, we don't know if we're going to be the buyers on this, or if there's going to be another buyer, but I'd like you to start the underwriting on it, on the asset itself. And then once we find out who the guarantor is going to be, then we'll plug you in with them. So then we know, you know, usually a lender's not going to waste their time with an incomplete packet. So that's a good way to tell if you have everything that a buyer will need or not.
Mm-hmm. And that's a perfect way of summing up. I mean, how you get paid your fees and how you set that. I think there's many folks on the buying side that think, well, why would I give all that money to a wholesaler, you know, on that spread? I know what they paid for it. I can look in the tax records, or I can see, and gosh, they didn't do, you know, they're asking way too much for this. Okay, well then go out and do it yourself. You know, is one answer to that. And, you know, why are you even calling me if you're a marketing machine and can do this anyways? Because that's usually not the case. But also one thing that I wanted to also highlight, Fernando, is that, it's no surprise that you've been able to start and raise a $12 million fund, because it takes what you're doing right now to get darn good at underwriting lots of deals and then packaging them up in a fashion where an investor can make a decision very quickly as to whether they want to buy it or not. And in your case, it's that you're the end buyer in some instances, but then if you're not the buyer, you're going to send it off to somebody else, but they have to have a very complete offering memorandum that, you know, they need to, in Shark Tank fashion, they need to be able to take a look at this and determine whether it's something that they want to buy or not. And I think that's where so many people either fail at wholesaling, as you mentioned, you know, where they just say, well, here's an address, go by and take a look and, you know, let me know what you think, versus somebody who hands it to them, not on a silver platter, but allows them to make that decision very quickly with a, you know, just a small amount of due diligence, or even just discovery before they put it under contract and they complete their due diligence. And those are the folks that, if they are hustling and they're looking to get into the storage business, even on the front end, that if they do a number of these deals per month or per year, and, you know, getting the fees, as you mentioned, you know, 11,000 to 200,000, if you're spending 40 hours plus just evaluating deals, filling your funnel full of facilities to look at, you can make a darn good living in this business on the active side without ever owning a facility. But you cannot underestimate, and nobody can do your pushups for you. You know, you have to learn how to underwrite, and you have to put together those offering memorandums no matter where you're at in the investment side of the self-storage business. So that being said, how do you approach those folks that maybe say, oh gosh, Fernando, this, you know, those fees are a little bit too much, or I'm looking for a little bit better spread. You know, the folks that are on your list that are maybe persnickety, or folks that maybe you're trying to get on your list that are maybe new to this anyways, you know, how do you approach, you know, filling your funnel of buyers that you put on your list?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So one of the things that we always try to operate from is having a mindset of abundance. And we want people that we surround ourselves with to share that same mindset of abundance. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to get onto our buyers list. It's not just fill out your information. You actually have to interview with me first. And I'll go through examples of this. And I'll say, hey, appreciate you reaching out and your interest in jumping on our list. You know, one of the things that we do are source properties at drastically discounted prices, where you're usually not going to be able to find the types of returns out on the open market that you will when you operate with our, you know, when you operate with us. And one of the reasons for that is because we know that we have the assurance behind us, either we can close on it ourselves or that you will be willing to close on it. One of the quick things that I do want to talk about is, you know, I don't count your pennies, and I'm hoping that you won't count mine. So when we send out properties, we'll send them out at a gross purchase price, so you won't even see how much I'm making. And if you agree that that property is worth that price, but then all of a sudden we get to closing and then you no longer want to close because you see how much I'm making on that deal, that's telling me that you're operating from a place of scarcity, a mindset of scarcity and not of abundance. And if that were to ever happen, you'll no longer get access to our properties. You know, we're providing a service not only to the buyers, but we're also providing value to the sellers by being able to come to them and tell them, hey, we can close quick. Whatever I tell you is going to be the timeline for closing, whatever I tell you that the price for closing is going to be, that's what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm a man of my word. So if all of a sudden now I get egg on my face because one of my buyers doesn't want to operate, that's going to be a huge problem. And I'm going to no longer want to continue this relationship. And I just tell them that up front. So I ask them point blank, is it going to be a problem for you if you see how much I'm making on a property, even if you think that property is a good deal at that price? And if, you know, if they give me any answer other than, no, I don't care how much you're making, if I think the price is good, then I'm not going to let you stay on my list. Yeah. So I think the first part is actually training your buyers mm-hmm. on how to work with you and setting that precedence up front. Mm-hmm. I touched on the other thing is that when we market our properties, we don't say, hey, the price is a million plus $20,000 for our fee. We say, hey, the price is a million 20. Do you like this price? And if they say yes, then we go through the entire process and they won't really know how much we're making until they are signing the HUD statement or the settlement statement at closing. Mm-hmm.
And
And I wanted to go through that knowing fully well what the answer was, but so to people could get in that mindset, because we've run across that, you know, in our education business, where people are hesitant to use a wholesaler, or buy something because they don't want that person to make a whole bunch of money if they could go out and find it themselves. And once again, the answer is, well, if you could go out and you were really good at this and sourcing deals and getting it done, then why are you even entertaining looking at a wholesaler, or complaining about those fees in the first place? And I too come from a place of abundance. And if the numbers make sense, and it's the perfect deal, then what difference does it make if it's a wholesaler that brings it to you that's making a spread, or a broker that's making a commission on it, and they've done the exact same work that you've done? That just makes no sense to me. So I guess a word of encouragement to the folks out there, if you have more deals than you can handle on your plate, then become a wholesaler. But if you're belly aching because you can't find anything, then don't complain about the fees that these folks are putting up on a silver platter for you.
The analogies I always use is, you know, are you not going to buy Apple shares on the stock market because you know the CEO is making $250 million a year? Usually not, right? Right. Mm-hmm. So why would you care how much I'm making if you think that there's still value there?
Exactly. It absolutely makes no difference. I bought a build. It was an industrial building that we converted to storage and had office space in, and we added more to it. And I paid $1.5 million for this property. And the gentleman that I bought it from, and I had knowledge of this, he paid three years earlier, he paid $10,000 for it. It was some kind of swap and some type of a distress situation, with the seller and some kind of an arrangement. Did I care? Did I try to negotiate him down to $20,000 and say, hey, you're going to double your money. Come on. Don't you think $1.5 million is too much?
All right.
It didn't matter because there was so much horsepower left in that property. And had I not, then 2.5 years after we bought it, we sold it for $3.9 million. And so it makes no difference. So my belly aching that I bought it for 1.5 and sold it for 3.9? No, not at all. It would have been a bigger spread if I got it for less. But $2 million, I'm not going to turn that down just because I'm angry that this guy only paid 10 grand for it. So I'm not being a hypocrite. So I appreciate you going through that exercise. And sure. just making sure that people understand that. So, Fernando, you're an awfully young guy to be doing that amount of transactions that you're doing. And I have a little more intimate knowledge than our folks out here. Tell us a little bit about the numbers, and you can certainly share your story of how you got into the business and how long you've been in it.
Yeah. So, I'll kind of go start at the beginning. I'm the son of two immigrants. When I was growing up, they constantly pushed into my head that, you know, the American dream is going to school, get really good grades, graduating with a good degree, and then working at a company for 40 plus years until retirement. And obviously that's not how the US economy functions anymore. Not every job carries a pension. And when I was looking at this when I was younger, I ended up picking up a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad when I was 16 years old. And that's the first time that it kind of broke my consciousness that there is ways of making money other than going and working for someone else. You know, if you're not working on your own dream, you're going to be working on someone else's. So that's when I knew I wanted to get into real estate. Flash forward, I did follow my parents' advice because they were my parents. So I still went and got a degree from a good university. I got a job at a Fortune 50 company, but very quickly I realized that that's not what was going to work for me. So I started investing in single family and multifamily homes. And then shortly after, started experiencing all the headaches that come along with owning residential property, evictions and toilets and tenants and trash. I have a story for each one of those things, probably more than a lot of people would like to hear at this point. So then I was in Indianapolis at the Real Estate Expo, and that's actually when I met you. You were speaking at one of the breakout rooms and talking about, it was almost like you were reading my mind from the front of the room, talking about the evictions and the headaches that come along with that. And that's kind of how I was sold on self-storage. I'm a very skeptical person in nature, so I obviously had to go back and do some of my own research. But at that point, then we decided to jump, both feet in to the business. I got my business partner that was also doing the single family and multifamily. I said, hey, you know, let's wind this business down and let's focus on the self-storage business. So the first 2 years that we were operating as self-storage investors, we actually didn't even buy one of our own properties. We just were wholesaling them just to show proof of concept that these were deals that people would actually pay for. So thusly, I should actually pay for them as well. After checking in with a few of my buyers after a year or two, I realized, man, I should have actually kept that deal that I sold to them. So we decided to start buying our own. Now, when we first started, we wanted to make sure that we weren't overwhelming ourselves. So in our first year of being operators, we only purchased one facility, and it wasn't a slam dunk deal. It was maybe a first or a second base hit. We bought it from a broker at a 7% cap rate at 100% occupancy. So there wasn't much value add to be done. But what I did like about the deal was that it was under market value as far as the rents go. So there was some movement that we could have made there with the rents. And it was within an hour and a half of my home. So if there was any alarms or if there's any fire that I needed to put out, you know, theoretically, or even, you know, real fires, we can handle that. And that gave me the confidence as a self-storage operator to go on and buy more. So after our first year of only owning one self-storage facility, in our second year, we bought seven more. And those seven were in areas that I could not drive to, North Carolina, Tennessee, all over the United States. But I really needed that first deal. And it wasn't a great deal. Like I said, we bought it at a 7% cap rate, which is nothing to scoff at. But after operating for about 18 months, now we're up to about a 10% cap rate. So I see that you can value add these properties. And that's what I always recommend to new investors is, you know, if you're going to be looking for that slam dunk deal as your first deal, guess what? You're never going to do a deal. You're just going to get hit by analysis paralysis and nothing will ever be good enough. So what I've been telling some people that just ask me for advice is look for something that you can get to, usually less than 3 hour drive from your home. Don't look for a slam dunk deal because honestly, you don't even know what a slam dunk deal is yet, even if it shows up. And then operate that facility for a year, just like I did. And then you'll start to feel so much more comfortable. You know, this is true of anything that you learn. Usually the learning itself is about 20%, but then you learn the other 80%, things that you'd never really know about from actually doing it and from operating that investment. And once you get comfortable operating that investment, then you can start looking at investing, you know, actively in different markets and places that you have to jump on a plane to go visit those. So once we moved forward and we started really growing our acquisition pipeline, we realized that to find those good deals, that now we know what they are, what good deals look like, we need to build out a pretty hefty marketing program or marketing campaign. For example, last year alone, just on marketing, we spent probably a little over $60,000. So this is one of the things I always tell, you know, some of those reluctant buyers, if you will, from our previous conversation, you know, if you want to find the deals that I'm finding, if you're having a problem paying what I'm asking, then why don't you go spend $60,000 to see if you can find a deal with no guarantee that you're actually going to ever see that money back. And most of them are like, well, I don't think I'll do that. And it's like, all right, well, that's how I find these deals. So if you want to do this on your own, then you're welcome to do it. I'll show you how I do it. Right. And that's when our marketing funnel really started exploding to the point where, I mean, we just don't have the capital to close on every or the bandwidth to close on all the deals that come into our pipeline. So now we're actually rolling some of these properties into that income fund. We have a couple syndications that we're working on, one that you and I are partnering on right now, a ground up development. And we just want to make sure that we're always focusing on cash flow, that the majority of our portfolio is a cash flow focused portfolio with just a smaller percentage being for more growth oriented investments. And the reason for that is, again, just being a wholesaler in nature, one of the great things about being a wholesaler is that you get access to all these smart investors. And so every time part of that interview that I conduct when they first come onto my list, not only it's, you know, mindset training, but it's also, hey, tell me what you've gone through. You know, how many recessions have you been through? Did you come out unscathed? Did you get your butt handed to you? why not? And I learned a ton of lessons from those guys without actually myself having to live through three or four recessions to learn these things.
Well, those questions, Fernando, and that's very smart. We continue to ask those questions of our investors because what that ends up turning into is another slide in our pitch deck when we have a webinar for our properties. Because if one investor gives us that nugget, that concern, that, you know, what they're looking for, ways that they've been burned in the past, and, you know, some of the assurance that that's not going to happen again. And, you know, what do you look for in an investment? You know, all of those aren't designed to weed somebody out. I mean, that naturally happens, and that can take two or three questions. But the other narrative behind those conversations and the interviews you have is all to build upon then the offering that you're going to put in front of them, and really even starts at, you know, the type of facility, you know, that you're looking at, because you want to put the best product forward that most investors are looking at. And that only happens with working with lots of investors and holding those interviews and asking them a lot of questions. So that's absolutely smart. Hey, one other thing I want to mention also, Fernando, you talked about you don't have the bandwidth. And one of the other things that I want everybody to walk away with and to realize, and we kind of touched on that, is that no, we don't want anything to ever fall off the table, you know, or off our desk if we're analyzing something. And that is one of the reasons why, even if it's, you know, we talked before that there are some deals that, you know, if we're looking for, you know, an exit multiple of a 2x or a 3x return on our money or our own internal rate of return or cash on cash on a deal, that's one thing. And there are other investors that may have lower standards or requirements. And those are the things that we want to push out to them as well. But even if something, you know, there's those of us at the level that we're at, Fernando, that and other folks that are out there listening right now, if you don't have the bandwidth to take these things on, and there is, at the end of the day, there's only so much that you can do. There's only so much of Fernando to go around. There's only so much of Scott to go around, the decisions that we have to make, the things that we have to do in our business. And so for that reason, that I see that some folks have that stymied them, and things that they were working on, or they wouldn't take on anything else, and they just said no, and they would take a pass just because they couldn't take it on internally. And again, that pains me to hear when people do that, when they could have done a little bit of the heavy lifting from, you know, their staff who they already have in place, or even taken a little more time to do, you know, the underwriting on it, the financial analysis, putting together a package and then putting it out there. So if anything, I think it's just more of an encouragement to folks out there. If you've got too many deals in your pipeline right now, I'll never be one to say that you need to turn off your marketing or dial it back because you can't handle the amount of deal flow you have coming into your organization. Because, you know, sending it out for referral fees or wholesaling is absolutely another way to add more revenue to the business without actually taking it on and having it be a drag on your resources. So anything you would add to that, Fernando?
Yeah. And one of the things that I really like about just having a large deal flow is the amount of underwriting that, you know, originally was just me doing, but now we have a whole underwriting team. Mm-hmm. And that's practice. That's practice and practice and practice. You know, if you only looked at 5 self-storage deals in your entire life, how do you know the 6th one's a good one? Mm-hmm. You know, I look at 5 to 10 self-storage deals a week. Mm-hmm. So over a 6-month period of time, that deal of a lifetime, because of that mm-hmm. volume, it comes around 2 to 3 times a year. Mm-hmm. And that helps not only myself, but our staff even start to whittle down the funnels coming in, because mm-hmm. based off of just seeing previous deals and how they shook out once the underwriting is done, we can usually look at a deal and within 2-3 hours say, hey, this is warrants further investigation, or hey, this is never going to work. Just go ahead and let the seller know so that they're not waiting on us, that this is not a deal for us. Mm-hmm. And that helps you kind of get through the processes. You know, a lot of new guys, they always ask me, you know, how should I get started? I say, well, you know, get your education lockdown. And then once you do that, just start underwriting as many deals as you can get your hands on, even if you're not going to have no intention of buying them. Mm-hmm. Go to LoopNet, go to Crexie, and mm-hmm. just start downloading OMs and just mm-hmm. running numbers over and over and over again. And then following those and seeing where they eventually sell at. So you know kind of where the market is, how far were you on based off the offer. I think it's a great thing.
And there's nothing wrong with, at the same time you're doing that, picking up the phone and having a conversation or two with the broker. You don't want to dominate their time and try to get training from them. But after you've underwritten it, and if there's something that you're scratching your head about, good or bad, or want some clarification on, you know, just be honest with them. Hey, I'm underwriting this deal here. This, you know, that I found that you've got in XYZ Arkansas, you know, tell me a little bit about my numbers aren't working out. And you'll begin to, once again, build that knowledge bank and that experience bank in underwriting and seeing how different brokers and analysts underwrite projects so that you know what to look for on the next one. So there's nothing wrong with practice, and just gathering more information from the folks that are in the business. And even if you have no business or no intention of buying it, a phone call here and there to help you, you know, understand what the market is doing is extremely helpful. So speaking of the market, Fernando, Tell us the changes that you've seen over the past 60 days. And I think most folks' crystal ball is very cloudy. In some cases, it's a broken or it's becoming more clear as we, you know, get beyond the COVID-19 pandemic and some of the other challenges that the world is facing right now with the recession and other events. But, you know, tell us what you're looking at for the end of 2020 and then beyond. What's going on over there at Titan?
Yeah, so, you know, historically, self-storage has performed very well. It's a very recession-resilient asset class. And we have noticed that over the last 60 to 90 days, our occupancies are up, our delinquencies are staying level. But on the seller side, what we've noticed is a lot of sellers that we have marketed to 3, 4, 5 years ago are now starting to call us saying, hey, just got your letter in the mail. It's like, I'm sure you did. And they're looking for offers. Same thing with investors and brokers and sellers that maybe 6 months ago, eight months ago, 9 months ago, you know, said, hey, your offer's too low. This is not something we can take. Now they're actually calling us back saying, hey, you know, we'd like to revisit that offer that you sent over. Is that still valid? And I say, well, it just depends on the market factors. I'm going to have to re-underwrite the property, but I still have all the stuff from when we initially made the offer, so I'll take a look and tweak it. So we're getting a lot more opportunities. Our marketing has been, the response rates have been climbing steadily the longer we've been moving into this, you know, shutdown economy. And I think it's just because some of these self-storage sellers, although their properties are producing great income for them, I think they're operating from a place of fear, and they'd rather have the cash in hand than sit on this, you know, cash flowing asset, which I don't think is the right thing, but I'm not going to tell them that. If they want to sell, I'm ready to buy, right?
So let's talk about also the private equity side. You've got your $12 million fund. You're always looking for investors to invest with you. What has happened, you know, when, as we head into this recession that was caused by COVID-19, you know, there's, I talked to and asked this question of so many folks, and, you know, some of the folks are going through challenges of getting people to get off their cash right now because they don't know what this looks like or the length of time. And these are kind of uncharted waters. And other folks are saying, hey, we're funding our properties very quickly. We filled our fund. We've got folks that are exiting the stock market. You know, they lost it all, or this is the second time they lost it all after 2008, and they're done, and they want to invest in hard assets that produce income. So just curious on your end for your marketing efforts, you know, what are you seeing? Is it a little bit easier? Is there more money flowing into your properties, your projects, and into the fund, or is it a little more difficult to get people to part with their cash?
Yeah, it's we're seeing a little bit of both, and I think it depends on the type of investor. So we're getting a lot of success with investors that pulled their funds out of the stock market. Typically, these are investments that do not produce any type of cash flow, and it is based off of the actions of someone that you don't really have any control over. When you invest into a large Fortune 500 company, you know, your couple shares, you can't really do anything with that unless you're Warren Buffett and you can show up to the meetings and really sway decisions because you own 40% of the company. You know, that's a different thing. But most of the people that we've been getting that have exited the stock market, number one, they're used to much lower returns. Even when the stock market was really cranking, you know, 8%, 10% return, but that was paper gains. That wasn't actual cash in their pocket. And all of a sudden now it's completely wiped out. So those individuals have been pretty adamant about jumping into the self-storage, and especially because when we look at, again, how self-storage produces in recession, based economies, it's a very smart place to place capital. The second thing that I always look at is, I understand your want to sit on cash. I do the same thing in, you know, uncertain times, but it doesn't make sense to sit on all of your cash. And the reason why is, I think the federal government, I recently read something in the last day or two that they plan on spending a total of $10 trillion in stimulus money to try to kickstart the economy again. Well, what happens when the government prints that much money, right? Inflation takes toll usually 3 to 9 months after the printing press has been turned off. And all that money that you're sitting on, that pile of money under your mattress, all of a sudden its spending power starts shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. One of the best things to do to combat inflation is to put your money into cash flowing real estate, because real estate de facto is a hedge against inflation. You know, God's not making any more land. So we have a finite amount of it, which means that the more people try to get into this, the value is always going to rise, and it usually stays on pace or even exceeds inflation when it comes to just the inflationary value increase. But then also you look at the types of projects that we like to do, and that's, you know, forcing value. So we're not just going to place money into something and just hope that inflation is going to increase the value, because in the end of the day, if your value increases only due to inflation, you'd still have the same amount of money you have today as you did, you know, in the past. When you're able to force equity by buying right, you know, you make all your money when you purchase, you just collect it when you sell. That has helped a lot. And what we've noticed is the investors, so not the stock market investors, but say the guys that are experienced with syndications, we've realized that they are now accepting lower returns because all those asset classes they're investing in before that were producing large returns are now in trouble. I've had quite a few investors reach out that originally they said, you know, 2 years ago, Fernando, I would have told you all I do is hotel. I'm not going to mess around with storage because it isn't sexy, right? Well, guess what? Now those sexy hotels went from 97% occupancy to 9%, and I don't think you're ever going to get any of that money back. I think the hotel space, for the most part, is not going to recover from this. I think there's a fundamental shift in the way that Americans and just people of the world in general view travel and view close quarters. And self-storage is one of those things where, you know, even at a huge facility, 1,000-unit, 140,000 square foot facility, very rare that you have more than like 5-6 people in the facility at any given time. Now, say a 1,000-unit apartment building, you have elevators and people. I don't think people are going to be really, you know, really comfortable with that anymore. And those industries historically have already been oversold. If you look at multifamily before COVID happened and hotels, the hotel space before COVID happened, the cap rates have compressed down to things that I thought were ridiculous. I mean, there's buildings in downtown Chicago that were selling at 2% cap rates, 3% cap rates, which means they weren't even making inflation. They weren't even protecting against inflation. And now when you see, you know, we have these skyscrapers that are sitting 60, 70% vacant. Those investors aren't ever going to see their money back or are going to have to fire sell unless they have the bandwidth to just stick it out for 12, 15 years before they start making money again. And that not a lot of people are willing to do that.
Yeah. When you look across the landscape at the various asset classes, as a result of this, and some of it will come back, some of it sooner than later, but many of these working on race within margins and flying high with the wind of a great economy at their back, they can do no wrong. It only took a 90-day hiccup, and all of a sudden, we immediately saw them going into forbearance, and then the foreclosures will be following 6 to 9 months down the road. And you know, it doesn't bode well for us across the, you know, entire economy and the entire real estate landscape. And I'm certainly not pointing fingers, but boy, we come back to this the same business model. Well, take a step back. I too, rich dad, poor dad, was the mind shift when I realized I'm not investing in the stock market any longer. You know, here's where my money is going to go. It's going to go into hard assets. because I can see it, touch it, feel it. And you know what? I don't know who, for the 2 shares that I own of a company, who is making those decisions, and they're never going to entertain, you know, going out for a cup of coffee or lunch or me stopping into their office to find out, you know, hey, how are things really doing at this company? But yeah, when you own your own company or you're investing with somebody, even the syndicator, and you can look under the hood and understand what it's like, and you can meet the accountant and the CFO every day because it's you or somebody that you have hired and you know what's going on, that makes all the difference. And so seeing the exact same things that you're seeing, Fernando, we've got new folks that are coming out of the stock market that are fed up with the paper that turned to vapor and left with nothing, that are jumping in. Some of our existing folks that have been on our list of our projects, they are holding back a little bit. But you know, the funding side of the syndication side of our business is alive and well and healthy because in storage, as we all know, we got a really good story to tell.
One of the things I'd like to add to that is,
yeah,
you know, when you look at the stock market, de facto, because the way that price per share and price per, you know, earnings per share are calculated, these companies, now this is not true across the board, but I'd say for 95% of the case studies, they're focused on the next quarter. That's always what they're focused on because they want to turn, you know, return mm-hmm. stockholder value, which means that they're making short-term mm-hmm. decisions mm-hmm. at the expense of long-term mm-hmm. growth. And this is perfect example is how all these big corporations, when the times were good and they were getting rewarded based from the economy for making dumb decisions, mm-hmm. you know, they were buying back stock. They weren't sitting on a cash reserve, because if you sit on a cash reserve, that's not, you're not deploying your capital, you're not growing it, and the next quarter's earnings drop. Mm-hmm. That's why I really like syndication, because mm-hmm. everyone's aligned on a longer term, you know, our self-storage income fund's a 10-year fund. So I'm making decisions that are yeah. going to be best in the long run, not what is going to produce the highest bump in value in one quarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The decisions that are made by the CEO and the CFO will affect his paycheck and his golden parachute long before the company ever, you know, exits and gets their dollar. Whereas, yeah, our projects, the ones that you and I are working on, are 3 to 5 years, maybe 7 years. And so, you know, our eye is always on the exit strategy, always, and never on the short term. And so and that is the difference. Well, Fernando, as we wind down here, once again, I appreciate your time, but you touched on the mastermind a little bit in terms of buyers for your properties, as well as you know, the community a little bit. And we're thankful to have you as a part of that, as one of the long-term members. You know, tell me a little bit about, you know, what that looks like in your experience has been, and how as a wholesaler, you know, being in that community has assisted yeah. you in the business.
Yeah, it's been huge for us. First on the education side of things, what I love about masterminds is you have people that are in the business actually operating, so that no one's giving you, well, if I was in that situation, here's what I would do. What everyone's saying is, I was in that situation, here's what I did. And here are the results. It may have been bad or good, but regardless if it was bad or good, you as the participant can learn from that story. You know, I love the phrase, you know, I stand on the shoulders of giants, because for you to be successful doesn't mean that you have to go through all the heartache. You can learn from other people's heartaches or from their success. And that will short track, you know, something that took someone else 10 years to learn and distill down, they can provide to you in 1 month. So that has been, just been huge. Also, being able to stay on top of the industry, because in times like these, things change rapidly and they change at different times across different parts of the country. So, you know, we have someone in Colorado that could say, hey, this is what happened to us, or someone in California that says, hey, here's what has happened to us. Some, you know, for example, I'm in Illinois, and usually our state will look at like states like California to start changing our legislation. And it takes a couple months or a couple years for legislation to travel from the west side of the country to the east side of the country, especially when it affects investors and tenants and property law. So that's been huge. On the wholesaling side, it's also been great, because number one, on the front end, I could see what are people looking for. You know, everyone's presenting deals, they're giving feedback on those deals, they're presenting experience that they've had with previous deals that they've purchased. So we can tailor what we're working on and what we're looking for, not only for ourselves, but for other investors in the group. And then, like you said, there's a certain level of trust that comes with operating and working with someone that's already in the mastermind. Because just to get into the mastermind alone, you have to exhibit a certain set of core values. You have to be a go-giver. You have to put community first. These are the things that I look for in my partnerships and my relationships with others. So if I already know someone's coming from the mastermind, there's already an inherent level of trust because I know they had to go through all those screenings before they'd be allowed to participate.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those of you out there who haven't read Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, who really outlines the mastermind concept and principle, I would suggest that book anyways, but I've been a member of three masterminds before we formed the Self-Storage Mastermind. And I guess as most entrepreneurs, you build something because there's a hole in the marketplace that you're looking for something. And if it's not there, you create your own. And so, you know, seeing the success and the ways that that I had grown from exactly what you mentioned, the experience that I had, Fernando, and other masterminds where people had gone through and experience challenges in the real estate business, it was only a matter of time before we realized that we needed to start our own tribe of self-storage folks. And it was basically, well, I wouldn't say basically self-serving, but that was certainly a piece of it. I wanted to be around, you know, fill a room with 100 plus A players in the self-storage community so that we can all share those best business practices and that have grown immensely as a result of it. But so thanks for sharing that. Fernando, as we wrap up, we're over on time here, but if you would, how about a resource, you know, whether it be a killer app, it could be, you know, software, some tool, you know, like an Evernote or like Slack or something that maybe you found in just in your day-to-day business that has been a game changer, or even in the self-storage side that you're really digging these days.
Yeah, I got, we're training a bunch of acquisition guys right now for the self-storage business. And the two resources I want them to go through and to actually report on once they're done is, number one, there's a book called Never Split the Difference, by Chris Voss. He was the lead FBI hostage negotiator for 10 years, turned business person. And he shows how using empathy in a negotiation can produce the best results for both sides. So he calls it tactical empathy. We use that in every negotiation that we do now in the self-storage business. But even in my personal life, when I'm dealing with significant others or family members, I found that book has helped me quite a bit. So that's number one. And then number two, to go even further into the sales, John Martinez has a real estate investment sales training that is probably the best that I've ever gone through. By far, it has helped quite a bit on especially working with self-storage sellers, because usually self-storage transactions move a little bit slower than single family or multifamily transactions. There's a lot more dialogue back and forth, a lot more building trust, because usually in situations, this is their baby. This is their one investment in their life. It's going to be the largest transaction they've ever met. And they almost sometimes treat it like, you know, you're showing up to their house to take their daughter to prom type thing. And they want to make sure the person that they're selling it to, not only is, you know, price is important, but that they're going to continue their legacy in a way that they appreciate. So those are the two resources that I'd recommend.
Fantastic. Well, once again, Fernando, I appreciate you and appreciate you taking that time out. Continue to keep the funnel flowing for all the folks out there that don't have the time to look for self-storage facilities. And what is the best way, Fernando, for people to get in touch with you if they want to learn more about what you're doing, or perhaps even get on your list if they pass the interview?
Yeah. So easiest way to get a hold of me is you can find me on all social media channels at The Storage Stud is my handle. You can thank Steven for coming up with that. He's the clever marketing guy. you can also go to our website, TitanWealthGroup.com or TheStorageStud.com. Both of those will give you access to apply for the cash buyer list. And then if you ever just need help or like to talk to somebody, I'm always around. My schedule is open for investors new and experienced to talk. So I look forward to hearing from everyone.
All right. Perfect, Fernando. And hopefully we get all this behind us. Looking forward to seeing you again in person.
Likewise.
All right. Take care. Be safe.
Thanks, Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening as always. Now, we're going to be talking about topics like this that are on target for the times that we find ourselves in. So it is important that you are listening to this podcast every single week, because the guests that I'm going to be bringing on and the topics we will be covering are relevant to what we are all going through right now. And it's just going to get better and better and better in terms of the content that we are going to be discussing. And it's going to be more timely than ever. So please make sure you subscribe to the show and make sure you're paying attention to these episodes as they are coming out during this period, as I am specifically going out and finding guests who are providing really valuable information you need right now. So thank you so much. We'll see you next week.